Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Adam Holland. How you doing?
Hey, doing well. Still trying to stay cool in mid-October, but no complaints.
Yeah, I know, man. I've been sleeping with the window open. It's weird. You know, I wake up and it's, you know, freezing and fog is rolling in, but like I'm all comfy in my winter blanket. I dig it. And then, you know, by mid-afternoon, I'm sweltering and taking my socks off. And I don't know, welcome to Oregon, I suppose.
Yeah.
Good football weather, and but football is not the only sport that the Ducks are playing. Oregon women's volleyball has been on a hot streak, although they've stumbled the last two games during this, or matches during the Washington swing. You've been covering women's volleyball a bit, and you wrote up Mimi Collier. What do you think about this team so far?
I think the team looks pretty good. A lot of potential. It's a, like, still a fairly young team, and Coyler is really, yeah, she's killing it. And I mentioned that in my article that this was only the second time that a freshman had won a Conference Player of the Week five or more times already. And the fact is that they're you know, still got the rest of October and then like November to play, and she's already won that award five times. And so that's not five times during the course of a full season. That's five times in almost half a season. So they definitely found a diamond in the rough with her. And I think you were seeing them really start to come together as a team during that hot streak. Now, unfortunately, I feel like I might have jinxed it a little bit by throwing that article out there about how they were on a hot streak, because they did stumble up in Washington against the Cougars and Huskies. Now, that being said, they still showed plenty of fight, especially at Washington, who's a top 20 team, and losing in five sets to both teams. So it wasn't like that they got knocked out or anything like really easily.
They didn't get swept. In fact, the Pullman one was a little frustrating because I think, you know, they were up, you know, and then they sort of let it slip away from them. It is interesting. Hannah Pukas has been absent, and she's, you know, she was on like, you know, one of the you know, it was interesting because she was on all these like watch lists for awards. And you know, on top of that, she would, you know, I believe she transferred from Washington State. And so like that was going to be the like, you know, welcome back game. And then she didn't play in either one of them. And I don't think we've gotten any word on why that is. It's just, you know, just sort of weird.
Had not heard any info about an injury or a personal problem or anything like that. So her absence was heavily felt, but also kind of confusing.
Yeah. You know, the momentary stuff aside, you know, the trajectory of this team looks pretty good. You know, like you mentioned with Mimi Collier and you know, some other players, like it's not exactly like a super senior laden team. Like this doesn't feel like a team that's like, you know, they've been working towards this for 4 years and this is the last hurrah, you know, of this, you know, group of ladies who've been together for all this time. This is like, this has been, you know, excellent recruiting, some good transfers, and it's a young team, you know, like it sort of feels like this team is just getting started, you know?
Yeah, it definitely kind of gives you a sense of what kind of women's basketball was like in like 2017, where you kind of were like, you have this unbelievable freshman who's, you know, already starting to set records, and you just have a young team overall. And, you know, historically, at least the last decade, Oregon's volleyball has been very good. And let's not completely discount them as a potential team to break that something other than track and field national championship lull we've been going through here.
Yeah, I definitely think that they are going to be a contender, you know, yet again. You know, their next trip, they've been playing at home a lot, and so they stumbled, you know, when they went on the road. Although they do have some, you know, some impressive road victories, you know, earlier in the season during non-conference play when they went to Coral Gables and they played South Carolina and Miami. You know, they had lost their other two, you know, Power Five out of conference games to Minnesota and Penn State, which were both ranked teams, you know, in Minneapolis. And then the rest of their non-con, slate was played in the state of Oregon, you know, a couple Eugene games and a couple of Portland games, interestingly. And then conference plays, had again been all in the state of Oregon. You know, they opened with, Oregon State, you know, in Corvallis, but then, you know, they beat number five Stanford, you know, and swept them, actually, you know, I, you know, probably the most impressive, you know, match of the season. But that was in Eugene, you know, and so was sweeping the Arizona schools. I mean, there was really was a 6-0 sweep against Arizona and Arizona State, but again, in Eugene. And so, you know, they leave town and they lose, you know, 2-3, both times to Wazoo and to Washington, and Washington's a ranked team as well. And they were missing Pukas, which is weird, you know, but it's still like, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of the road record. And so, you know, this upcoming weekend, they're going down to Los Angeles, to play USC on Friday and UCLA on Sunday. Neither team are ranked right now, but I think they both still have like pretty decent teams and may wind up ranked, you know, later on. I wouldn't be surprised about that at all. What are you looking for, out of the performance this weekend against the LA schools?
I'm looking for kind of, like you said, it was a little frustrating at Washington State, for them to be able to hold on to leads a little better. Now granted, like we said, this is a young team. Young teams tend to do better at home. They're not quite as much road veterans. But once they get ahead, it's important to really go ahead with that defense. And that's kind of like what I've been impressed with Coyler is that not only has, you know, she been registering so many kills, but so many digs as well. And so that just shows the talent that she has on offense and defense. And so, yeah, really what I would like to see out of them is just a little more killer instinct on the road. I think as a young team, that should really kind of bolster their confidence. And the schedule looks pretty favorable for them the rest of the season. They play a lot more home games. They get another crack at the Washington schools. And so, yeah, I think this weekend will tell you a lot about their ability to kind of bounce back, to show a little grit and grind on the road there. And, yeah, hopefully we can get a couple wins out of this and keep the momentum they built from that win streak going.
Well, I think that's the basic structure of women's volleyball is that you play You play everybody in the conference twice, one at home and one on the road. Although I think they only get, I think the exception is Stanford. They only get one against them, and it was at home, and Oregon swept them. So, like, that's nice. Stanford doesn't get a chance at revenge, I guess. So yeah, but you know, getting a couple, you know, to a couple of these road, you know, series out of the way, so that the balance of the rest of the schedule, you know, is pretty friendly. You know, looks nice to me. So the USC game on Friday night is going to be on Pac-12 networks, and then on Sunday the game. Or match against UCLA is going to be on ESPNU on the mouse. So, you know, tune in. I got to say, I did this last week this Sunday. We're recording on Tuesday night. I was doing my film review of the Oregon versus Arizona football game on Sunday. It was such a short game because it went to garbage time that, like, I actually finished my film. Usually it takes me like 2 days. Cause like I barely get the video processed by Sunday, and then I get like a little bit of film study in, but then like I'm doing most of, you know, the real film study and the article composition on Monday. But on, with the Arizona game, it was over so quick, you know, it was like, you know, only 46 snaps on offense, only 36 on defense before garbage time, that I actually finished it up while I was watching, them, play Washington. And like, boy, I got to tell you, like, if you've got like a project to work on Sunday, having one screen to watch volleyball and another screen to do like your work, like it's great. Like, I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to do that, in the future, as well. I highly recommend the experience because volleyball is so fast paced. There's always, you know, something going on. It's just great. I love it.
Yeah, I agree. Always been an enjoyable sport for me to watch. I have to be a little biased because my wife is a former volleyball player. But no, it's high octane. It's exciting. It's fun. And yeah, Oregon has a lot of potential for this season.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk about the football game against Arizona.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, Adam, I suppose you traveled down to Tucson to watch this one.
Believe it or not, I wasn't able to make the trek, but it was still still another enjoyable performance to watch.
Were you worried about eerie desert magic undoing the Ducks yet again?
You always wonder a little bit about that, just considering everything that's happened. Them ripping up their natural grass turf in favor of artificial turf kind of gave me a sense that maybe the curse was going away with that grass. But I had full confidence that they would take care of Arizona, and that they did. Now, I cannot say that I thought that they would be as good on the defensive side of the ball as they were. Arizona, even though, you know, they're not like in the upper echelon of the conference, they're not in the lower either. And they've got a legit offense, especially through the air.
And, yeah, definitely.
Again, you know, you saw, you know, a score during garbage time for Arizona, but for the most part, you know, they had been holding them, you know, under 20 points for like almost the entire game, at least any time that the first teams were facing sure. each other. And this is Lanning's calling card. This is what you're seeing. And he's, you know, even against high octane offenses in the Pac-12, he's being able to institute it so far. Now, the real test is going to come against Chip and, you know, his offense, because you know how good those offenses are. I'm really liking.
We got a bye week. I got to do so much film study on UCLA. Come on, man! Like, give me a break. I don't want to talk about UCLA till next week.
yeah. All right. I'll leave that for next time.
But, I'll say as far as the Desert Magic goes and like Oregon exceeding expectations, like I definitely felt like a big bump in confidence when Washington went down to Arizona State in Tempe earlier in the day. Cause I was like, that's it. The football gods are appeased. You know, the gods of the desert, you know, have gotten their Pacific Northwest sacrifice. And like that game, I mean, Washington looks like their defense is actually just really just straight up bad. And, you know, that's why the walk-on backup quarterback was able to shred them. Yeah. But like there was still like, and so like on the fundamentals, Washington deserved to lose or at least to be in a super close game. But like there was zany Desert Magic in that game, you know, like the throw where Penix puts the ball on off of the lineman's helmet and it pops up for a pick six. It's just like, there it is. There's the Desert Magic. Okay, that's it. Yep. That's what you get, you know, desert gods. Like now you have to leave us alone, you know, in the next game. I gotta say though, for doing film study on Arizona, this game, you know, went down pretty much how I expected, at least on offense. You know, when Oregon had the ball, I mean, just Arizona's defense. Well, their rush defense is atrocious, and you know, so Oregon running all over them was not a surprise at all. And then, like as I've been saying for a long time, you know, if you can run the ball, you are like 75% of the way to winning a game. You know, it's just such a versatile tool. And then like Arizona's pass defense, it was interesting because like they had the three games that they played in the middle of their five game schedule to date, you know, it was like 43% defensive efficiency. In other words, the opponent 57% of the time when they would throw the ball, you know, would gain sufficient yardage to stay ahead of the sticks, which is not a good number at all. However, in their first and in their fifth game against San Diego State and Colorado, their pass defense efficiency jumped to 63%, meaning, you know, only 37% of the time when the opponent passed the ball, they got enough yardage, which is like, that's a crazy swing. Like a 20-point swing in efficiency is like bonkers. And I was like, you know what? I'm watching film, and this is, you know, and you know who San Diego State's quarterback is?
I cannot
say. It should be a familiar name to you. He was a former Duck. You want to guess?
Well, I know Robbie Ashford is in Auburn.
Now he's in Auburn. He's doing not bad. He's kind of fun to watch. I turn on Auburn games actually just to root for him. No, San Diego State starting quarterback is Braxton Burmeister.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And
well, anybody who's been following ATQ for many years now knows how I feel about Braxton Burmeister.
So. Yeah. So like, I feel like, you know, I put that in my preview article where I was like, I kind of think that, so like between 63% in games 1 and 5 and 43% in games 2, 3, and 4, it sort of averaged out to like a perfect 50%. But I was like, you know, I don't even think that they are 50%. I think they're closer, you know, to being, you know, a bad passing defense, and they're just getting buoyed by like terrible quarterback play, you know, from Burmeister and McCown. And I feel like as soon as I put in their stats are buoyed by playing Braxton Burmeister, I was just like, everybody who read that article is like probably nodding their head at home, you know, like, oh yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. So, makes total sense all of a sudden.
So, you know, that was, you know, Oregon scored touchdowns on 7 straight drives, and it's like, you're not, you know, doesn't even matter how good the opposing offense is, really, if they're allowing that, you know, there's no way they're going to win a game. But then like, and then the other thing is that Arizona's rush offense is just not very good. Yes, I know they broke off that, you know, big run. It was weird. It's actually funny that there is a question on that big run about which linebacker is out of position, whether it's supposed to be a twist or if, you know, it's supposed to sort of play straight. And so I put in my article, I think it's Flo who's responsible for this. And then everybody on every forum that I posted my article to just wants to tell me like, no, it's Sewell. Look, it's Sewell. It's, you know, I gotta like take this lesson, you know, that I should put like one, you know, dramatically eye-catchingly potentially incorrect thing in every article because it ups audience engagement. Apparently, I was just like, I've heard from about 50 different Duck fans today, like, no, it's Sewell, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point of conversation, that Sewell is actually human when it comes to tackles and missed assignments.
Well, that has been an interesting thing because, you know, like both Sewell and Flo came in at the same time with the same, you know, rating. But like Sewell's been playing the whole time and Flo's missed a whole lot of time with, you know, various injuries and other concerns, I think. And like you can see the difference in their like just present developmental level. You know, Flo's just playing a little more like a wild man. So, yeah, I don't know. Like it was interesting to sort of provoke that discussion. The other thing that was really interesting about Oregon's defense against Arizona's passing game, which is definitely like their best aspect of their football team and like the for real part of their offensive like talent upgrade, like what Jed Fish did, you know, those dudes that he brought in are like for real, is that Oregon employed like a new defensive structure on a bunch of their snaps. They deployed like a modified 33 stack, which is like they hadn't done that before. That was really interesting. It makes sense, you know, put a third inside linebacker on the field because like the way that Arizona's passing attack works is really, they really just do one thing in their passing game that's pretty good, which is these like, you know, these dig routes, you know, about like 12 to 15 yards deep in the middle of the field. And like, yeah, so just have another inside linebacker in there to provide more underneath coverage of those throwing lanes, and it worked. You know, like they instead of those, they were hitting like shorter slant passes. You know, they were completing them, but instead of getting like 20 to 25 yard gains off of those digs, it was more like 7 yard gains and then immediately getting tackled. Which, like, even if you're allowing that to happen, which like Oregon did a pretty good job. There was like 56.5% defensive efficiency. You know, in other words, Oregon flipped Arizona from being a good passing attack that was like above average in all of their stats to a bad, you know, or below average one anyway. Like that was how effective Oregon's passing defense was. But even though they were allowing some completions, it's like, you know, if you're only getting 7 yards at a time, and in order to go 75 yards down the field, you've got to, you know, execute more than 10 plays, you know, successfully. On the other hand, you know, if you're getting 20 yards, you know, every pass, you only gotta, you know, succeed on like four of them. So like, you know, it's a big difference forcing a team to be methodical, and the vast majority of teams that Oregon is going to play make having forcing them to pull off methodical drives against the talent of Oregon's defense is just not something they're going to be able to do. And like, that's definitely what you saw in this game, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And then on the flip side, for Oregon's passing game, you just continue to see this this new attitude and this new outlook for Bo Nix. Granted, you know, against Georgia, he didn't look good, but nobody did. That was, you know, probably the worst game Oregon's played in a long, 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 long time.
Oh, yeah.
But then you look at the rest of the season. And it seems like Nix is finally having fun playing football. I think down at Auburn, he was, you know, under a lot of pressure. His father went there. The SEC fans, you know, can be absolutely brutal if you're not competing for a national title. It looks like he's enjoying himself out there. But not only is he enjoying himself, but he's just become so reliable for Oregon with his passing.
Accurate. I mean, that's the, you know, coming off of the Anthony Brown year where, like, you know, I defended Anthony Brown, you know, a lot. I don't actually think he was a terrible quarterback or anything, but just like, but just the inaccuracy was so tiresome, you know. It's just like, Anthony, that is not where the ball is supposed to be placed, you know? And like Bo Nix is not, I mean, can you think of one inaccurate pass that he's thrown? I mean, he has a couple, but like they don't like stand out in your memory as just like, you know, pulling your hair out the way that we were doing last year, right?
No, yeah, it's night and day. It's like he's got a magnet in the football or something hooked up to the receiver's hands at this point. I've just been very impressed and pleased with how efficient he's been.
Well, I mean, the other thing that I'm sure he's enjoying at Oregon compared to when he was at Auburn is that he has an offensive line that is actually capable of protecting him and wide receivers who are actually capable of catching the ball, and like a lot of them. I mean, it was remarkable, you know, when I was doing film study on Auburn, which I wound up doing for like a variety of projects over the years. It's just like, that team doesn't have an offensive line, doesn't have any wide receivers. And it's like, how did you expect the quarterback to succeed? You know, like, you know, but like football and football commentary is so quarterback centric that it's like, well, the passing stats are bad, therefore Bo Nix is bad. And it's like, come on, like, can you, you know, does no one have the capability of writing any more like sophisticated analysis than that? No, I guess the answer is no, because I have a job.
I agree 100%. Now, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and badmouth all of Alabama's quarterbacks, but a lot of times their success is pretty much based on the skill players and the protection the offensive line gives them. And you see that a lot. And you see that a lot when they transition to the next level. It's like, oh, okay, they were like the greatest player on earth at Alabama, and they get to the NFL, and it's like, huh. So I agree. I think Nix, unfortunately, was a victim of, poor protection and just not enough guys to throw to.
I also think that, like, play calling at Auburn was not, real great, and I think that we've all sort of been pleasantly surprised by Kenny Dillingham, as a young signal caller. I think you've got an article going up later this week about, Kenny Dillingham's play calling. I'm looking forward to reading it. It's been a lot of, it's certainly been enjoyable to watch like a full open playbook and utilizing Oregon's talent advantage against a team like Arizona that just can't, They've got a couple of individual pieces who are okay, but like, just on the whole, they can't resist what Oregon wants to do. And the other thing that was nice to see in the Arizona game was that I really appreciated Dillingham was that, like, he would change up the play calling based on the Arizona defensive structure. So, like, I put this in my article and talked about it a bit, that, like, Arizona starts out with a two high safety structure and they're running the ball and throwing short passes. And then, because Oregon is so successful running the ball, they pull down one of the safeties into the box and Oregon runs over that safety. So they're like, damn it, we got to get both safeties into the box now. And Oregon is still successful running the ball, but now they don't have any safeties over the top. So what does Oregon do? They start throwing deep shots. They threw that big one to Chris Hudson. They threw a nice one to Coda and to Franklin and a couple other guys. It's just like, yeah. And so it's like you start by running the ball and then it's like it accelerates, because the way the defense has to adjust, opens up, deep throwing opportunities, which is like, this is like, this isn't football 101. This is football like 201, I guess. But like, it's still nice to see. It's nice to see play calling. It's just like, I'll exercise in a talent advantage in one aspect of the game, and then as the defense, changes, I will take advantage of those changes and express my talent advantage in a different way that's appropriate. It's just like, oh, this is like sensible. Like, there's, I liked seeing that. Like, I guess it sounds a little simple to say, but like, yes, you should call the plays against the area where the defense is weakest right now. Like, huh? How about that?
Yep. It's freedom. It's the freedom that Lanning is giving, and it's fun to see. It's made Oregon's offense fun to watch again.
I also, something that I never thought that I would see, they've been running some I formation plays, which, like, I don't think I had seen that since like 2003, in Andy Ludwig year.
Definitely not since they went spread option.
And I counted it up, and Oregon's run seven different plays out of the I formation, inside and outside power, obviously. But they've also run QB sneaks and a fullback dive once, although in garbage time. They against Stanford, they did a bootleg to the right, although Nix saw it was open, and so he just scrambled for the touchdown, didn't throw it. They threw against Wazoo, they threw a tight end leak out to McCormick for a touchdown. And then in this game, they added the seventh play, which was the Matavau tight end sweep play that they got a touchdown on. So, like, So not only is this a new formation that Orkin's put on tape that opponents have to worry about, but like every game they've added a new thing. You know, since it went BYU, you know, Wazoo, Stanford, Arizona, each of those four games, they added something new out of the I formation that they would run. So it's like, okay, you know, so now Oregon's going to the, you know, the stretch here. They got six conference games to finish the year. And it's like, good luck, guys. You know, Oregon's line up in the I formation. What do you think it's going to be? So far, it's been seven different plays in every game. They've added a new one. So maybe it'll be an eighth one that you haven't seen before. Like, yeah, I just like imagining like opposing teams, like in practice, like looking at this film and just like being like, oh, Jesus, like what is this fresh hell? Because nobody runs the I formation, you know, with, you know, anymore. That was Stanford's thing and Oregon took it. Like, yeah, yeah, I like that, you know.
Keep them guessing for sure.
Let's see what else. The other thing that the guy that I wanted to mention, I didn't actually go after him too hard in this article, although I've gone after him in a couple other articles. Is Jeffrey Bossa at inside linebacker? He's had a really mixed bag, you know, like in this game, he has a sack, which is great. And like, maybe only Jeff Bossa gets that sack because it's the one where like, you know, it's actually really interesting simulated pressure that he gets in. Like he comes in late as part of that pressure. And the quarterback is flushed and Rodgers, I think, sort of walls him off going one way, but then Laura sort of like gets outside of him, but Bossa is right behind him and he catches him by the ankles to get the sack. Right. Which like maybe a little slower of an ILB wouldn't have gotten that sack. But Bossa did. On the other hand, there's another play and I decided not to put it in my article because there was really only one instance of it. And so I didn't want to, you know, put an unrepresentative clip in, but like Boss is going to stop a short yardage run and the running back just hits him and knocks him back like 3 yards. Do you remember that play?
I do. Unfortunately, it's definitely like, not the proudest moment.
Yeah, I know, man. It's just like, that's the thing. You know, you have this converted safety who's playing inside linebacker. And on the one hand he can do, you know, some pretty cool stuff with his speed. And on the other hand, like, yeah, he's going to bounce off a running back, you know, like,
yeah, I don't see something like that happening to a Casey Matthews or a Troy Dye or something like that. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. So like, I don't know, man, like it's interesting that he's getting this much play, but I got to say, like, I was glad to see Justin Flo get back. Like I would like him. I'd like him to really get up to speed because Sewell and Flo together, I know this is cliche and we've been saying it since 2020, but like if Sewell and Flo are playing at a high level as five stars and like their talent is totally real, like that is unstoppable in every other option that Oregon has at inside linebacker. And it's good that they have multiple options. They've got Keith Brown, Jackson LeDuc, Jeffrey Bossa, and a couple of freshmen too. And in fact, the freshmen have been playing a little bit during garbage time and they don't, and I saw them in the spring game too, and they didn't look bad. You know, I like how deep Oregon is at linebacker, and it's definitely, you know, it was a big problem last year that, you know, that they had that rash of injuries and they were having to play walk-ons and stuff. You know, I like how deep they are, but like everybody on the field who's not Sewell and Flo is, you know, necessarily a step down, even if they're playing, you know, pretty well. It's just, you know, the talent's just off the charts with those guys. Like, there's a play that I put in my article where Flo looks like he's just teleporting behind the left guard. Like, it's crazy. He just like zoop. Like he just sort of in an instant, in the blink of an eye, flashes 2 yards upfield to get a tackle for loss on the running back. It was just like, that was the play that was like immediately before the crazy eye look that Yogi Roth was talking about.
He was heavily missed last year for sure. And I know I kept preaching it too, but I also think that Mr. Funa was missed more than people realize last year too. And I think having him back out on the field also helps make a big difference.
Yeah. Funa got a lot of run this game. Actually, it was interesting. They, up until this game, it had been mostly DJ Johnson and then Funa would only come in, you know, certain times. In this game, it was much more like a 50-50 split, between Funa and Johnson. So like, yeah, I enjoyed seeing that. Like I do think that like that, I think that Funu's a really good, really experienced player. And like, he's, you know, he's, his body has changed, you know, like he definitely slimmed down. Like he doesn't look like, you know, a short defensive tackle anymore. And then speaking of defensive tackles, like, boy, I like Oregon's defensive line. Like, I really like this. This is by far the biggest and deepest and most talented in the Pac-12. And they're really, you know, showing up. They really just dominate here. Like, and then I also liked seeing, you know, the kiddos in the defensive backfield. I liked seeing Manning before he got the targeting ejection. I liked seeing Florence. Hell, Florence got a pick. That was great.
Yeah, it's great to see Florence getting more and more play time and starting to live up to the hype that he came with. I remember doing articles about him because he was, you know, kind of like, was he on board? And then he wasn't on board, and then he was back on board. And he was somebody that I really wanted us to nab, and I think he's starting to show why.
Well, yeah, and then Oregon's playing Tryquest Bridges at cornerback, which, like, I think I understand because he's fairly experienced and he's fairly reliable. Yes, you know, so far, like, about once a game he gets beat. Every cornerback gets beat from time to time. Like, I don't think it's an unacceptable rate, but, like, it does happen every game. And I think it's because he's not naturally built like a corner. You know, he's built like a safety, and he should be playing safety. And I think there's probably the reason for that. You know, you saw a little bit of it against Arizona was, you know, like Manning and Florence are young, and they're not quite as reliable, but they are just like much more naturally cornerbacks. And like the day is going to come when those guys are reliable enough to displace Tryquest Bridges, and it won't be like, oh, you lost your job, old man. It will be like, oh, good, you are freed up to go play your more natural position at safety, you know, which, like, I'm looking forward to that day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will we'll talk about the Ducks football team, sort of a mid-season review now that they've got six games in and they're going into a bye week.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So I'm going to be writing an article that goes, you know, I've been collecting all these stats for Oregon in each individual game, but it's easy enough to just add them up and come up with, you know, the overall stats. I'm going to be writing an article about that for next Tuesday. What do you think, you know, qualitatively, you know, what's impressed you about this team? What do you think they still need to work on? How do you feel about this group, Adam?
I've been feeling very good week after week. I'm not going to lie. The opening debacle, I said, this has got to be one of two things. Either we are that bad or Georgia is that good. And I really want to believe that Georgia is that good. I think with what you've seen from Georgia, yes, they are that good. But I also think, though, that, like I said before, that was one of the worst games that I've seen Oregon play in I don't know how long. Their bounce back from that has been exceeded expectations for me. I was definitely expecting their offense to be a little more high octane. I was expecting good defensive things, you know, just given the talent that we have. I'm not sure I was expecting the offensive output that they've been showing, where they're just putting up 40 plus every single time, and not only that, but doing it so effortlessly and holding back a lot, taking their foot off the gas because they're so far ahead, they could be averaging 50 plus a game easily. And on the defensive side of the ball, just that defensive line's dominance in conference and everything. The only frustrating thing I've seen from them since the Georgia game was the amount of penalties that they had against Stanford. Almost to the point where, like, Stanford had more penalties from
more yardage from penalties
than they did their offense produce.
That
part was frustrating. But aside from that, man, I really since the Georgia debacle, I would give them like an A minus. The minus only being because of the Stanford penalties. I've really been impressed with what I've seen so far.
You know, there's been a couple of like single game issues. You know, like against Wazoo in the first half, there were those red zone, you know, problems. And then Stanford, you know, there's some penalty problems. And against BYU, you know, they gave up some passes. And you know, first of all, it was really nice to see against Arizona the first, like, you know, truly like this, you know, complete performance where it's like no notes, you know, like, no, I got no complaints about this at all. But like, you know, maybe more to the point, like, there's been nothing that lasted more than, you know, hell, not even a full game. Like, nothing's lasted more than a half. Because remember against Stanford, you know, remember when they put up the stat about the first half, second half, you know, penalty disparity? Like, it was really just a first half problem. And same thing with the Wazoo, you know, play calling thing. And the same thing with BYU's passing. You know, like, you know, none of these, you know, issues have lasted more than a game or really more than a half. You know, like, Oregon's been good about correcting its problems, too. You know, they haven't let, you know, problems fester, which, you know, that's pretty encouraging, too. The other thing you mentioned, you know, like, you know, how bad the Georgia game was. The thing that's interesting about that is that, you know, I'm able to compile all these stats and, you know, the success rate and the yards per play and the explosiveness rate. And like Oregon's, and the other thing is what I'm able to do with the database is like selectively exclude games to see, you know, if it really changes stuff. So like, The two games that I'm probably going to wind up putting four different columns in my article, one which is, you know, all six games, one which is, you know, the five games excluding the FCS team, one which is the five games but excluding Georgia, and then one which I think is the truest representation of what Oregon is, which is excluding both of them, so just BYU and the three conference games that they've played so far. And the thing is, with all four of those, the offensive numbers don't change. It doesn't matter which games you exclude. Like, the offensive numbers are basically identical. There's a little bit of a rush efficiency boost when you exclude Georgia. Like, they go up from, but I mean, the numbers are insane. They go from 70% to 73% efficiency, which is like, those are bonkers numbers. Even just 70 is a bonkers number, you know, and like the yards per play, they go up about like 0.35 of a yard. Like, if you exclude Georgia, you know, that's nice, but it's like, they're still excellent, you know, numbers. The offensive numbers don't really change. Oregon was moving the ball pretty effectively against Georgia. They had some problems finishing drive, and then there was the two interceptions, but like, you know, on the fundamentals, on like a per play basis, Oregon was moving the ball fairly effectively against Georgia and in ways that the rest of the season, you know, it hasn't been different. You know, like, it's actually been very, you know, consistent and excellent. I mean, like, it's 63.5% efficiency, you know, against, you know, throwing the ball, 10.3 yards per play, 25% of them are gaining 15 plus yards. All of those are fantastic. Those are championship caliber numbers. And then the rush offense is even better. You know, it's 73%. You know, it's 7 yards a carry. It's a quarter of plays are gaining 10 plus yards, which is just like, that's insane. Like, those are beyond championship caliber numbers. It's hard to lose games if you're rushing. Like, almost three quarters of your runs are successful, you know, which means if Oregon wants to, you know, if they just line the ball and want to run it four times, you know, first down, second down, third down, fourth down, the odds that the opponent stops all four of them and prevents Oregon from picking up a first down, you know, it's 0.25 to the fourth power, you know, whatever that is. It's a small number. And like, it's just not going to happen, you know, like the offensive number. Yeah. It's under 1%. Like, it's not going to happen. Like, Oregon can just, you know, run the ball all they want. And like, oh man, is that exciting, you know?
Oh yeah. Ground game equals success. You can run the ball. You're going to win football games. Period. And yeah, the ground game has been amazing, especially, like I said, considering that, you know, they have very talented running backs for sure, but not the most experience as far as like playing together and playing in Oregon's system. So,
where you really see the effect of excluding the Georgia game is on the defense and specifically the pass defense. The rush defense numbers don't really change that much. The rush defense has been good all year. You know, if you include the Georgia game, it's a little over 60% efficiency, meaning the opponent only gets 40% efficiency, which is really good. If you exclude the Georgia game, it jumps to like 68%, which is like, that's a huge jump, and you go from championship to like super championship, but it's still like, you know, you were already a good rush defense, and you know, excluding Georgia makes it a, you know, phenomenal rush defense, but sort of like you were already over the bar. Where there's a demonstrable transformation is in the pass defense. If you include the Georgia game and exclude the Eastern Washington game, which is like the category that makes Oregon look the worst, you know, you know, it's close to 50%, you know, efficiency, and it's allowing, you know, 7.4 yards per attempt, and it's, you know, like 12% explosives. Those are still like good numbers, you know, like they're good defensive performances against some Pac-12 teams, and BYU are buoying that, but like Georgia alone was just such a disaster, you know, in the pass defense that like it really just tanks the rest of Oregon stats. But if you exclude Georgia, and even if you exclude Eastern Washington as well, like it jumps to 62%, the pass defense efficiency, and allowing less than 6 yards a pass, and allowing, you know, only about 8%, you know, explosiveness rate. Those are excellent passing stats, you know? And so like when they put the graphic up on this, you know, the Pac-12, right, you know, in this game against Arizona puts out, you know, like Oregon's last place in the Pac-12 in terms of their pass defense. And I'm like, that's really only if you include the Georgia game, which like nobody's going to be able to replicate Georgia. And that's only if you include all the garbage time stuff, which like, you know, like, of course, when Oregon is putting teams into garbage time in every single game, the opponent is behind and is going to throw the ball against Oregon's backups. Like, that's so misleading. You know, it feels like that's a really misleading stats. Oregon's pass defense is not bad. It's not the best pass defense in the universe. I'm not making that claim. But, like, it is definitely, you know, more than good enough to win the Pac-12. And it's just the Georgia game and a bunch of garbage time is distorting the record. Like I really feel like, you know, I feel like, you know, going into this last stretch of conference games, every team is going to look at the raw stats and say Oregon's pass defense is terrible. We'd be able to throw the ball all over them, and then I really think they're in for a rude awakening because they're not performing, you know, proper, you know, data exclusion in order to get to the true story.
Yeah. Definitely, and there's no doubt about it that the garbage time will equal less impressive pass defense stats. Happened a lot in 2010 when Oregon was just demolishing opponents. They'd be up by 40 heading into the fourth quarter, and you know, then they'd throw in second team. The other team would go strictly to the air, and the pass defense didn't look nearly as, you know, impressive as it should have. You know, given that they had guys like John Boyette and Cliff Harris in the backfield, they had a great pass defense. It just didn't always show up. So I agree with what you're saying, and I do think that Oregon's pass defense deserves a little more praise than it gets on paper.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, when you have a really good rush defense, like, you know, a rational opponent is going to be like, well, we're not getting anything on the ground. I mean, like, Arizona, if you exclude their longest run, they were averaging 2.2 yards per carry, which, like, you might as well not be running the ball, you know, like you're getting stuffed, you know, on every single run. And like, so yeah, of course you're going to throw the ball, you know, like you're behind and you can't run, and Oregon's got, you know, fourth string defensive backs in, like, yes, you know, of course you're going to throw the ball. Yeah, no, like anybody who's not excluding garbage time and just going by the raw stats on that is just really dumb. And you know, I certainly understand why people want to include the Georgia game, because like that was a real game, you know, like it's definitely for real that happened, and it was a debacle. But like a lot of that is because like Georgia knew Dan Lanning's playbook, you know, like, and they were calling plays that like I mean, I put clips of it in my article where it's like, this is not either. This is a play that they didn't run at all last year, and I haven't seen him run, you know, watching the rest of Georgia's 2022 games, or they do run that play, but he's throwing it to the guy on the first read who's not his first read. That's his like third read in the progression, but he knows what's where the blitz is coming from. He's just throwing right behind the blitz. And it's like, you only get to do that if you have Dan Lanning's passwords, and only Georgia had those, you know, like it's not that that game didn't happen. It's that that is impossible for anybody else to replicate. And so it's kind of like not relevant going forward, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. They had a sizable advantage simply because, you know, they knew Lanning like the back of their hand. Like you said, other teams are not going to be nearly as prepped for that. And heading into the second half of the season, yeah, you're gonna see some tests for Oregon here, and it's going to be fun to watch.
All right, you're gonna have to stay tuned for my article on Tuesday. I'm also gonna do a couple other things. You know, I'm gonna throw in some offensive line comparisons. Oregon's actually been running a three-man rotation at their offensive line, you know, between Marcus Harper and Ryan Walk and Jackson Powers Johnson. You know, that's something that was pretty rare for me to see, you know, even as recently as like 5 years ago. But I feel like more and more teams now are doing offensive line rotations where they're like, we have a sixth man and we're going to play him, you know, and we'll just, you know, swap him out. And that way, you know, everybody's getting experience, and, you know, and that way we're, you know, well situated for if somebody becomes unavailable or for other, you know, reasons why it'd be beneficial. What have you thought about that? Like, has that surprised you as well? Or what do you think?
No, I think it's a good idea. And if there's one thing that Cristobal did right for us, it was recruit offensive linemen. He set us up with a treasure trove. And when you have that, and when you have the ability to rotate, because, you know, offensive line is such an important position to stay healthy at. People seem to overlook how important it is to have a fully healthy offensive line. If you want an example, throw it back to Marcus Mariota's last year at Oregon. Mm-hmm. When Jake Fisher was absent for a few games, he was absolutely running for his life out there. And this is the Heisman winner. And it just goes to show you the importance of that cohesiveness and that healthiness of the unit. And so I think it's a good strategy. Offensive linemen do a lot more work than people think. You know, they're just like, oh, just stand there and take up space. But no. They're down there battling in the trenches the entire game. And to rotate in and out, to be able to get that rest, to be able to, you know, get a breather, come in fresh, and then dominate even more. I think it's a great strategy. I think honestly, it's something you'll probably see teams with depth at the offensive line start to replicate more and more. Now,
I have granted, actually
you may
seen
not
it
see
from,
as much in the Pac-12, but
I actually have seen it out of some Pac-12 teams. Like I think. I don't think that anybody in the Pac-12 has nearly as talented or effective an offensive line as Oregon does. But I have noticed more teams, you know, I think for a long time, the philosophy for offensive line was just like, you get your five guys, you get them to gel, and then you never change the lineup, you know, unless you have to. And I've actually noticed, you know, teams, even though, like, I don't think they have the same talent, but they're like, let's do that too. You know, so like Arizona, for example, that was rotating two different guards, 56 and 58. I've noticed UCLA doing it. I noticed Washington's sort of been forced to do it. They've actually had different offensive line configurations in most of their games. And like, whether that's experimentation or not, that doctrine of you play the same five guys every snap, no matter what, until somebody breaks a leg and you are forced to put in a new dude, like that, I don't think it's just Oregon. Like, that philosophy seems to be losing its grip, you know, throughout the Pac-12. And I think that's, you know, pretty interesting. I definitely think that teams compare notes more than fans are aware of or would think is appropriate. Like, you know, fans think that, you know, because Oregon and Washington, for example, are rivals, that means their coaches are at each other's throats. And I'm fairly certain that's not the case. They compare notes and watch each other's film and call and talk to each other. Like, you know, like it's really a fraternity. And so like if one team starts doing something good that sort of breaks orthodoxy, you see it pretty quickly get absorbed throughout the Pac-12 for that reason. I don't know. I like seeing, because I'm such a scheme nerd, like I enjoy, you know, watching these guys work and sort of collaborate. But I definitely like Oregon being a trailblazer too. And they definitely have been that on the offensive line. I feel like the greatest explanation for why Oregon has been, you know, the class of the conference for most of the last 20 years has been that they've enjoyed an offensive line advantage, you know, between Steve Greatwood and Alex Mirabal, and now what, you know, Adrian Clem is doing with Oregon's offensive line. It's just like, yeah, that's your football team, man. You know, and if you have an advantage at offensive line, it's like, it means you can play real football. Like I feel like a lot of the commentary about within the Pac-12 from, you know, people who are habituated to watching Pac-12 football have certain like expectations for what a good quarterback is and what good play calling is, that assumes that the pocket is going to collapse within like 2 seconds and like assumes that you're not going to be able to run the ball up the middle. And then you have Oregon, which is this outlier because they can do those things. And like, I don't know. I feel like commentary hasn't like caught up, you know, to this like reality that like, no, you know, other 11 Pac-12 teams, you're doing this wrong. Like there's a reason why you guys suck compared to the other, you know, power conferences where they have like good offensive line play. You know, it's because that allows you to play sound fundamental football and you're not like scrambling and having to do broken plays and zany plays and scheme guys open, you know, constantly, you know, because the guy needs to be open immediately off the snap for you to complete the pass to him, because he's not going to be, you know, your quarterback's going to be on the ground if you're running a route that takes more than 2 seconds to develop. Like, you know, yeah, I enjoy that advantage that Oregon has, and it looks like they're going to have it for quite some time. So I dig it.
Yep. Always good to see.
All right. I think that's going to do it for this week. You got any parting words of wisdom for us, Adam?
Well, just that we're looking forward to your statistical review and excited about the volleyball team moving forward, and definitely excited about the football game coming up in a couple weeks here. Should be a barn burner, and I don't see the Alton streak being snapped anytime soon.
It is a pretty impressive streak, I'm definitely glad that it looks like Oregon's four toughest games that remain, you know, on the schedule against UCLA, Washington, Utah, Oregon, not Oregon State. They're playing that one in Reser. It's 3-3 for the remaining part of the season, but it's looking like the three tough ones, UCLA, Washington, and Utah. And those games are all the home games, and Cal, Colorado, and Oregon State, who all look like, you know, shouldn't pose that much of a challenge. Like, you don't want to overlook any games, obviously. And I actually think the Cal is starting to look more and more like a trap game to me. I don't know. I got to dive more into film study of them, but I have this whole bye week to do that. So, but yeah, like it's nice to play the less talented teams on the road and the more talented teams at home. I dig that. And Autzen is a hell of an advantage. And now that the students are back. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.